old. How good and pleasant it is when brothers dwell in unity. Then he gives us some pictures of what it's like. It's like the precious oil on the head running down on the beard. On the beard of Aaron, of course, Aaron typifying the priesthood, running down on the collar of his robes. So there's this picture here. The anointing oil, the oil of service, the oil of refreshing, the oil that represented the Holy Spirit. It is like the dew of Hermon, which falls on the mountains of Zion. Another analogy here, this walking out in the morning dew. There's a freshness to it. For there the Lord has commanded the blessing. And here's the blessing, life forevermore. The teaching here is that when unity is appreciated and valued, and as the New Testament talks about, that we're to strive, we're to agonizomai, to promote and develop and protect the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace, that there's blessing there. There's life in that carries on forevermore. We've just read together what tonight? The inerrant, infallible, all-sufficient Word of God. Let's use that as the backdrop, because when you come to a congregational business meeting, when you go to a really big Baptist business meeting, which is what the Southern Baptist Convention is for a couple of days, then you really want unity to prevail. And I can tell you that happened a lot in Dallas, thank the Lord. You may be seated. Okay, I want us to look at these handouts. First of all, I want Michelle to play a video for me. This is I found this video. It's a brief, but very informative. If we were to pass out some sheets tonight and say, okay, draw for me what you think the structure of the Southern Baptist Convention is, depending on where you grew up, many people would say, well, you've got the Southern Baptist Convention, and then you've got this thing, this Baptist General Convention of Oklahoma, we hear you talk about, and then you've got the Tulsa Baptist Network, Tulsa Metro Baptist Network, and then you've got Bethel. And if you were talking about Presbyterianism, Lutheranism, Methodism, Episcopalianism, you would not be far off. I mean, that's the basic structure. But we're Baptists. The word, if you're not familiar with it, the word autonomy. You'll hear it come up in this video. Autonomy. Autos, nomos. It's from a couple of Latin and Greek type words. Self-law, self-rule. We rule ourselves under the Lordship of Jesus Christ. Go back and read your Constitution and bylaws. That's what it says when you get in the preamble, by the way. The highest authority, human authority, in the Southern Baptist Convention is the local church. The Tulsa Baptist Network does not instruct us. The Baptist General Convention of Oklahoma does not instruct us. The Southern Baptist Convention does not instruct us. Each of those bodies. In fact, I gave a little bit of a talk at the Louisiana Baptist Convention years ago when the conservatives were trying to push something forward. And so on the floor of the convention, I gave a talk and used the term equidistance, that if you draw a chart, you've got the local church at the center. You've got coming out of that, and the angle has nothing to do with hierarchy. You've got the association we were a part of, and Northwest Association. Then you had the Louisiana Baptist Convention, then you had the Southern Baptist Convention, and showed them. I said, these should be equidistant from one another and to us. They were not happy with what we were doing, and the conservative advance came up and they said, we wish you would be equidistant from us. And so, and I took that with a grain of salt. But the point was a good Baptist point that I made. These bodies all are under the authority of the local church. We take what we can in terms of advice and counsel and offers of fellowship and instruction that comes, and we use that if it helps us advance the mission and ministry God has given us here. We are members of the Tulsa Metro Baptist Network. in friendly cooperation with them, because we embrace what that collection of Baptists stand for. We are members of the Baptist General Convention of Oklahoma for the same reason. We're members of the Southern Baptist Convention for the same reason. If any of those bodies ever deviate from critical positions of orthodoxy, from norms, we'd have a problem. That will be my closing observations when we get through here. So, Michelle, show us this little video. I thought it was a very fascinating teaching moment. We'll make these kind of things available to you later, of course.
The Southern Baptist Convention is not a church. It is a network of autonomous, self-governing, self-supporting churches. At its most basic level, the Southern Baptist Convention is an annual gathering of representatives from cooperating churches who have organized a specific set of cooperating ministries with a defined set of ministry assignments, annually elect trustees to govern those ministry entities, and adopt a budget to help fund those entities through a cooperative giving model called the Cooperative Program. Currently, the SBC has an executive committee, an auxiliary, the Women's Missionary Union, and 11 ministry entities: International Mission Board, North American Mission Board, 6 seminaries, Guidestone, Lifeway, and the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. Some think the SBC has a top-down structure, that it exercises hierarchical authority over other Baptist groups, with authority flowing downward to and through state and regional Baptist bodies, with local churches at the bottom. But this is a flawed model. In reality, each local church is fully autonomous and retains its full authority. Local churches elect up to 12 messengers who attend the SBC annual meeting to adopt the SBC budget and elect trustees and members to its various boards, institutions, commission, and committees. Local churches may decide to participate in cooperative ministries with other cooperating autonomous Baptist bodies, such as affinity groups and fellowships, local associations, and state conventions. The Southern Baptist family is comprised of a network of cooperative relationships among and between churches and various autonomous Baptist bodies. Note that all arrows radiate out from the local church. Local churches retain their autonomy with no outside authority over them except the Lordship of Jesus Christ.
Okay. Good little succinct, but very informative video. This gives you kind of a visible and a visual picture of how we are structured. Okay, with that in the background, we may show that again at the end once we've gone through these things, because this may clarify questions you had about that. By the way, at any point in this, if you have a question, don't hesitate to raise your hand and ask, because I want to be sure I'm clear. This is very clear to me, but I've lived in Southern Baptist context for a lot of years, so I take a lot for granted, even language that I might use. But I want you to look at this, the fast facts, the first sheet, the cover sheet that you have there. Look at the structure of this. Over 47,000 churches make up the Southern Baptist Convention. Now, except for these 2 or 3 days in June when we just gathered in Dallas for our annual meeting, when you talk about the Southern Baptist Convention, you're talking about the executive committee, which is called the ad hoc, or the convention ad interim, during the interim, because the rest of the year, even though we're a part of that, the Southern Baptist denomination of churches is what's functioning. The convention only exists in terms of the churches gathering 2 to 3 days a year in June for the annual meeting. And you see the membership, 15 million. We've lost membership in recent years. It used to be about 16 million. But that's not always bad, because you see that the worship, weekly worship attendance is a little over 5 million. That's a 33% participation. That is not good. It's not healthy. That's why groups like Founders Ministries have been laboring for decades now to call for a reformation in the church. Tom Askell presented a resolution at a Southern Baptist Convention annual meeting several years ago now, resolving that we would return to historic Baptist roots of regenerate church membership, that only people who give evidence of being born again are proper members of a Baptist church. And so that was presented several years ago and adopted, by the way. You see the baptisms, 254,122. Then the cooperating state conventions. If you remember that picture we showed you in the orb, the local church, coming out from that, the Southern Baptist Convention, and then coming out from that as well as state conventions. If you lived in Louisiana, like I pastored there for almost 30 years, the Louisiana Baptist Convention was that state convention body. Here it's the Baptist General Convention of Oklahoma, just different nomenclature, same idea. The up north of us, because some of the more pioneer territories can't sustain the weight of a state convention, the Kansas-Nebraska Convention. They've come together as two states. There are 41 of these, is the point of that. And then local associations like the Tulsa Metro Baptist Network, the TMBN, which is an area of churches around here. Then we meet for different meetings, different purposes. For example, Linda Hare attended, while Karen and I were gone to the convention, Linda Hare attended a meeting at the Tulsa Metro Baptist Network where they brought in someone to train the churches on an active shooter awareness. All kinds of healthy things that come through here. Mission opportunities, ministry opportunities. So they flow at different levels, is my point. Look at your mission board numbers. International Mission Board. These are, you notice, this is as of February. We actually had a commissioning service of 79 missionaries while we were at the convention, most of whom you could not show their faces. You could not tell where they were going because they're going into these unreached people groups in these hard places. But that's so it's constantly happening. But you see a mission force of 3,551. It shows you the unengaged, unreached people groups. About 3,200 people groups on the planet still have not been encountered in a meaningful way with the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's the group we're going after. You ever heard of the 1040 window? Any of you heard of the 1040 window? If you take the 10 degree latitude, 40 degree latitude, and run that ribbon around the globe, the 1040 window is where most of the unreached groups are in the world. Then you have domestic or North American missionaries, 5,262 of those. Churches planted. Recent in the last year, 691 existing churches coming from other groups and joining the Southern Baptist Convention, 284. You come into the Southern Baptist Convention agreeing to be in friendly cooperation with the SBC churches. You commit to participate giving to SBC causes. That can be through the cooperative program. It can be giving to one of our seminaries, giving to international missions, but the commitment to kind of put your money where your mouth is. It's not a whole lot of money, by the way, but to give to these causes shows you're in friendly cooperation. There are doctrinal parameters. Let me speak to that just a minute. If a church in the Tulsa Metro Baptist Network, our local network, if a church that's identified with us were to ordain a homosexual, which would be against our doctrinal understanding of who can be qualified to be a pastor, then we would have a meeting of the Tulsa Metro Network and determine to remove that church from our membership. We can do that. Same thing at the Baptist General Convention of Oklahoma. Same thing at the annual convention. There can be a motion called to refuse to seat messengers from a church if it's determined and proven that there's a doctrinal deviation that has taken place. It's fairly significant. Then look at the seminary students trained. This is, when you look at these numbers, 22,000 students trained. The largest training worldwide of any identifiable body of people, training people for ministry. Then there's seminary extension. The mission dignity thing is about a move that's been developing to care for pastors and their spouses who are retiring and don't have sufficient retirement. The diversity that's growing. Let's come back up to the right column, then we'll come down to the bottom. You may not be aware of disaster relief. Southern Baptist disaster relief is only behind things like the Red Cross and sometimes ahead of them on any disaster on the globe. When Haiti endured that horrible earthquake in 2010. Southern Baptists were on the ground. When we were in Louisiana and the tsunami hit Banda Aceh and the areas over in Indonesia when Blaine and Tanya Mays were still there. A doctor out of our congregation then who was a part of this went. And we were some of the first people on the ground, stepping over the dead bodies, taking care of all the tragedy. Southern Baptist Disaster Relief is highly acclaimed. Oklahoma Disaster Relief, at the Oklahoma Convention, same thing. If there's a flood, if there's a tornado, just pay attention when the news is talking. And you will see in any disaster, any crisis like that, the Southern Baptist Disaster Relief shows up. We show up with large food trucks, with shower and washing facilities. We come on the ground. We have people with chainsaws. I don't know if you remember or not, back when the ice storm hit us, been quite a while ago now, over 10 years ago, I think now, we actually housed a group of volunteers from the Southern Baptist, and they're all volunteers, all people from congregations. If you're interested in doing something like that, you can see me later, and we'll get you hooked up in some training. But they came and they stayed in our gym, and they went through this whole area cutting limbs up that were falling on cars and houses and helping people get their lives back together. It's a wonderful ministry, disaster relief. Children's and family ministries. We care for children and orphans in different ways. Crisis pregnancy centers, placing children in care facilities. And you see how that's happening. The Baptist Collegiate Ministry. If you're familiar with the BCM, Baptist Collegiate Ministry, when I was in college, it was the BSU, Baptist Student Union. But those young people that plug into that when they're in college are given opportunities for mission service all over the world for summer missions. And so you can see, and you're going to see in a minute, you know, why this emphasis here. Well, it's at the very heart of why the SBC was founded. And then you come down to the racial and ethnic diversity. There's people that are not happy that we're not more racially and ethnically diverse, but we are becoming more so. And you can see that. Anglo churches of the 47,000, 39,000 Anglo or predominantly Anglo, African American churches, 3,000, Hispanic churches, 2,000, Korean, 734. Native American, 399. So that is growing. And if you track these things, if you go online at sbc.net, check this page out from year to year, you're going to see that's tilting in the right direction. Then regular church giving. $9.5 billion is collected in Southern Baptist churches annually based upon reports that are sent in. Cooperative program dollars given by the churches, just shy of $500 million given through, let's get language right here, people talking about giving to. You don't give to the cooperative program. You give through the cooperative program. Cooperative program is a funnel. It's a channel whereby we fund our seminaries and our mission causes and those kind of things. And then the designated giving. So that's a quick snapshot. Any questions about any of this right here on this Fast Facts page? Did y'all get copies of these things? Okay, good deal. Yes, Karen. Okay, where are the seminaries? Good question. My alma mater, Southwestern Seminary, is in Fort Worth. New Orleans Seminary is, guess where? New Orleans. Then they've changed the name. Golden Gate is now Gateway Seminary, and it's in the San Francisco area. They have an incredible work going on out there. Midwestern Seminary is in the Kansas City area, north of us. Southeastern Seminary is in North Carolina. And then Southern, of course, they like to tell you they're the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. That was the first one started. That's in Louisville, Kentucky. So those are our six seminaries. And I can tell you, we have reason to be very encouraged about the presidents in those seminaries. Jeff York out on the West Coast is an incredible leader and visionary. David Allen, not right. I'm sorry. Went blank. Young man, good friend at Midwestern Seminary. It will come to him if I don't think about it too hard. He is doing a great job at Midwestern Seminary, really, really loading up ministry to the local church. Chuck Kelly, who's at New Orleans Seminary, certain little irony here. I played Royal Ambassador basketball against Chuck Kelly in high school, when we were in high school back in Beaumont. And Karen delivered one of their babies when she was doing labor and delivery nursing. But that has nothing to do with the fact that he's president. It's just kind of an interesting little piece of trivia, I suppose. Chuck Kelly's a capable leader at New Orleans. Danny Aiken is at Southeastern. Again, a great guy. A little concerned about some things that are happening out there now. Al Mohler at Southern Seminary is probably the guy that's best known. He's very articulate. He has high profile. He's a young, not so young anymore, but a brilliant theologian, articulate. If you're not plugged into his podcast called The Briefing, you might want to get that. He's very insightful. And then at Southwestern Seminary, my alma mater, another one of the concerns coming to the convention was that Paige Patterson, who was the president there since 2003, I think, was removed May 30th, just before the convention, for impropriety in terms of how he had handled sexual assault on Southeastern's campus when he was president there, and then Southwestern's campus. But Dr. Jeff Bingham, who has stepped in as the interim president, is a fantastic man. I mean, Bingham could stand in this pulpit and preach, and you would lap it up. You'd lap it up. So, good leadership at the seminary level. Thank you, Karen, for asking about that. Any other questions about this before we move on? Okay. When it's talking about what? These would be places where we house children that are coming out of crisis situations, a foster care arrangement that Baptists have. We have children's homes. The Baptist Children's Home here in Owosso is a part of this extension. Those kind of things. Yes, J.R. Weekly worship attendance. Okay, what now? Right. Well, of that year, how many baptisms took place in an annual? And remember now, when we're given these numbers, not every church reports. This is a voluntary reporting through our annual church profile, the ACP. So if a church doesn't report, we don't have that. But yeah, this is what's reported. And it's obviously a concern on one side. On the other side, If we're getting tighter on our membership and we're baptizing believers rather than just anything that stands still long enough to get wet, then we're heading off some problems. So there's a tension there. We want to see baptisms up, but we want to see baptisms of genuine converts. So it's when you go to an annual convention, that is a thing you're going to hear talked about from anybody that gets a platform in that area. We actually had a discipleship report that came from Robbie Gallaty. I don't know if you've read any of Robbie Gallaty's stuff. He's at Long Hollow Baptist Church. And he's a sharp guy. And they did a study on what's happening to us. And the conclusion is we're not doing a good job of discipling. We've got a lot of people making, quote, decisions, but we're losing them. You have all these baptisms and the numbers continue to dwindle. Whereas you and I know that if we're making real disciples, those folks stick. They stick. And we're not having a lot of good sticking going on. That's a good observation on your part. Anybody else? Okay, let's move to the next sheet. Meet Southern Baptists, all right? This is a 6 pages front and back, so three pages. And it just gives you a good snapshot. 173 years we have been a denomination. I'll talk about the history in a little bit. But for that, I want you to drop that first paragraph there. We were started in May of 1845 in Augusta, Georgia. 293, they called them delegates then. They're called messengers now. A little shift in nomenclature. But here was the statement. The founding charter identifies the singular focus for the purpose of eliciting. What's elicit? To draw out, to receive, to elicit, combine, to bring together, and to direct the energies of the Baptist denomination of Christians for the propagation of the gospel. That has not changed. There's never, in the different changes we've experienced in terms of tweaking this, tweaking that, it's never been suggested that even be touched. In fact, what happened, that was 1845. 1925, There was this recognition that we needed to practice our giving to the denomination in a different way than we had been. And up until that time, If you came into a local church, if you were allowed to come in and speak about a mission opportunity and you had the most compelling story, you normally got the monies. Well, in 1925, we changed that to a unified giving, which expresses this combine, to what we call the cooperative program. You hear some people say the cooperative program, but emphasizing cooperating, the cooperative program. And through the cooperative program, here, for example, in our giving, a certain percentage of the monies that we give to our budget goes from here to the Oklahoma Convention in Oklahoma City. The state convention takes the portion, sends on to Nashville, to the executive committee. And then that is what the budget is made up from. And out of that budget, every year, at least 51% of that budget goes to international missions. And you'll see, I think there's a breakdown in here somewhere. You'll see the percentage that goes to North American missions. And then, of course, to our seminaries and different entities. But there's a commitment. And so by that, think about this. When you read that we have 3,551 missionaries on the field overseas, and we have 5,200 in North America, if you give anything through the ministry here, then you are supporting every bit of that, because we send a portion of ours to the, and so that way we're not picking and choosing, having to say, well, do we give to this, do we give to that? It's through the unified giving of the cooperative program. Every now and then you read some fellow who I get email and Facebook messages, well, you're giving to a corrupt, this is corrupt, that's corrupt. There's not a better way to give. Nothing's perfect. As long as people are involved in it and we're not in heaven, it's not perfect. But it is the best way to support worldwide missions to advance the gospel. And here's the deal. I have friends on the mission field today. It takes $50,000 to $60,000 to $75,000 to keep one of our families on the mission field every year. We haven't gone beyond that since I've been here. We're not in danger of having tainted money sent. It's a wonderful mission giving plan, cooperative program, but it comes out of our, the point I was making is, it comes out of our purpose to elicit, combine, and direct the energies. All right? You see the numbers there. Just kind of look over that. It gives kind of a profile. We're very large to very small. We are, the size of our church is probably right at average size of a typical Southern Baptist church. So when you see the larger ones out, that's not typical for Southern Baptists. All sorts of cultural types within us, all sorts of age, all sorts of emphases. Cowboy church, motorcycle, just kind of interesting to read that. The race and ethnicity, primarily Caucasian, but growing African American, Hispanic, Korean, Chinese, Native American, Russian, and many other ethnic backgrounds. This is pretty impressive. The Lord's worshipped in more than 100 languages each Sunday in Southern Baptist churches across the U.S. More than 100 languages. And then theological perspective. We went through a shift. In 1979, I just naive as I could be, walked into my first Southern Baptist convention. I was fresh out of seminary. Had graduated in August of 78, went to the convention in 79 in Houston. And it was the launching, I didn't know anything about this, the launching of the conservative resurgence, because we had professors teaching in our seminaries who were pro-abortion. We had professors teaching in our seminary who were soft on marriage and sexuality. We had professors teaching in our seminary who taught evolution, and on and on and on, different seminaries. And so the conservative resurgence was launched. And after about 1990, through the process that is necessary to change out leadership through our trustee system, for example, if you can imagine, when the Southern Baptist Convention gathers, there's a committee on committees that's appointed, and they stagger out. So over about a 3 to 5 year period, it totally changes over. The committee on committees appoints the committee on nominations. Again, they're a staggered group. A committee on nominations then will do its work to replace trustees who are retiring from our entities. It took a long time, you can imagine, with that approach, to swap out trustees where you had a trustee system of people like you and me saying, we're not going to employ people who are pro-abortion. We're not going to do it. And so we began to have a change of the guard. And so that today you can say, and I hope we can continue to say this, as we'll mention at the end of this, that we are Orthodox, historically Orthodox, conservative, Bible-believing Christians in every area, social, ethical, moral. So, but that's how we flow. And so you see that little bit there. You can read over this. I didn't actually print these out tonight intending to read all this to you, but to give you something to take home with you, to learn more, if you want to learn more. This closer look, I thought it was interesting. I printed this out, the first paragraph there. Among doctrines, Southern Baptists emphasize that the doctrine of the local church autonomy, or Article 6 of our Confession of Faith, says the New Testament Church of the Lord Jesus Christ is an autonomous local congregation of baptized believers. When you hear me say these kind of things, when we're talking about the Lord's Supper or baptism, I'm just not making this up out of thin air. This is coming from hammering out theological positions and putting them in writing. Associated by covenant in the faith and fellowship of the gospel. And so we're designed to promote autonomy. No church should feel impinged upon. If a church deviates in a major way from our doctrinal positions, morally, ethically, theologically, then the bodies that they belong to, as I said a while ago, the local association can determine to remove them for being out of fellowship, as can the state convention, as can the Southern Baptist Convention. But it does not necessarily follow that because one does, the others will, because of our autonomy. And so you can read about that. Look on the back of on page 2, where there's a list of the entities. And it shows you their founding dates. There's the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, in addition to these 6 seminaries. They're housed in Nashville and have an office in Washington, D.C. That's the ethical watchdog. They're supposed to speak to power on behalf of Southern Baptists and to inform Southern Baptists what is happening in the political and cultural climate. This is where we have a problem right now, and we'll come back and talk about that in a minute. The Executive Committee, as I said a while ago, that's the convention ad interim. In the interim, they're made up of people who are, again, Committee on Committees appoints Committee on Nominations. Committee on Nominations fills boards, and this is one of the places they fill is the Executive Committee. The Executive Committee right now does not have a president to lead it because Frank Page, who was the leader, stepped down for moral failure. The International Mission Board does not have a president to lead it because David Platt, who's a wonderful young man, stepped down to go back and pastor the local church. Southwestern Seminary does not have a president to lead it because the trustees removed Paige Patterson for the reasons I mentioned earlier. So we have 3 of our entities that their trustees will be choosing replacements to lead these institutions. It's something we ought to pray about. So you see the entities there. And then you can go in and it talks about what the Executive Committee does. But I want you to notice on page 3, here's the financial breakdown of the operating budget of the Southern Baptist Convention. 50.41% goes to international missions. That does not include Lottie Moon. 22.79% goes to North American missions. 22.16% to theological education. 1.65% to the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, and then 2.99%. Typically, when you look at an entity this big, there's a real top-heavy expenditure on operating expenses. Not so in the Southern Baptist Convention. We have very good stewards of that. So you see those pieces of information, and then here's on page 4. This is a picture. If you want to get a graphic of what we were talking about a while ago, the local churches. At the top, the different entities subservient to that. Then you see how the budget breaks down. So, I'll give you a good graphic illustration of the convention operation. So that's any questions you have about Meet Southern Baptist or or a closer look of Southern Baptist. I don't want to belabor this, so we're going to move through it because we've got some other stuff we want to talk about. Okay, so those are the pages I want you to take home with you. Read over them. By the way, you read over these and you come across something and go, what is that? I hope you would feel free to reach out to me. And if I don't know the answer, immediately we'll find it out for you. I want to talk about a brief history now. A history. Why is there a Southern Baptist Convention? Well, you have to go back to the days of Andrew Fuller in England. Andrew Fuller, William Carey, John Sutcliffe, John Ryland Jr., and Samuel Pierce, five English Baptist men who formed the Foreign Mission Society when William Carey was convinced God was calling him to go to the heathen with the gospel, and he would ultimately go to India. He lived in a climate, by the way, when there were people who said, God's going to save whoever he's going to save. We don't need to go to foreign people like that. In fact, one fellow said in the meeting where he shared his heart, sit down, young man, you're a fanatic. God will save the people without your help or mine. And so that was the climate they were in. And so these five men forged together a bond and a brotherhood and agreed to send William Carey. William Carey preached his famous message in 1791-92, expect great things from God, attempt great things for God. And they launched him. Andrew Fuller said to him after that meeting, brother, we cannot go with you down into the well, but we will hold the rope when you go down into the well. And the rope was that of prayer and support for the mission and ministry. So you go back into the 1790s when the modern missionary movement was launched. People had lost the fervor. There were pockets of exceptions, but by and large, Christendom had lost the fervor that's expressed in the apostles in the first century, who, as they were described, had the people who are turning, these guys who are turning their world upside down have come here to trouble us also. That was the missionary advance of the early church. And so it's relaunched in 1792. Well, Baptists in America are having a heartbeat for that as well. And so they see the need to come alongside and to support Carey and others like him, who are fellow Baptists, even though they're across the ocean. And in a strange providence of God, as the triennial convention is formed, it's called triennial because they only would meet every 3 years, but they were formed to accommodate a foreign mission thrust and a domestic mission thrust. All right, let's keep that spinning for a minute. Adoniram Judson and Luther Rice, two Congregationalist pastors who have the call to ministry from their denomination, who are going to travel overseas, going to Burma. Congregationalists now sprinkle their babies. They're not Baptists. Baptists baptize only believers, supposed to. Well, since these guys knew that they were going to be bumping into Dr. Carey, and Dr. Carey was a formidable Greek scholar, they decided we need to bone up on our Greek New Testament so we can talk with him if we happen to see him when we land in India. In an amazing providence, on the way over, Adoniram Judson becomes a convinced Baptist. Luther Rice would follow in his path later on. So when they land, he's not debating Carey. Even though Anne Haseltine Judson, his wife, was not convinced initially and warned Judson about deviating, you're going to lose your support back home. William Carey baptized Adoniram and Anne Judson. Later on, Luther Rice. And so they had to write back to America. We have good news and bad news. Good news is we've made it. Bad news, we're not Congregationalists anymore. So their mission board dropped them. Luther Rice, in an incredible act of self-denial, traveled back to the States, was never really allowed to be a part of the foreign mission, spent his life traveling the Eastern Seaboard, speaking to Baptist churches to convince them to support a man who left these shores as a Congregationalist, landed on foreign shores as a Baptist. The Triennial Convention stepped in and began to support these men. And it grew. And so we had domestic or home missions as well. But in about 1834, I think, 1823-34, a controversy arose. You have any idea what was going on around that time in our country and over in Europe? William Wilberforce was challenging Parliament to bring an end to slavery. I told the folks Wednesday night, it's just an antidote here, that of all the slaves that were enslaved, they were enslaved by Muslims in Northern Africa, and they shipped them to Middle Eastern countries, they shipped them to Central and South America, they shipped them to Europe and shipped them to the New America. 5% of the total slave population landed in America. That's horrible. Shouldn't have been one. But here we were in the immoral situation of slavery. And then add to that, how would you like to be pastor of a church in South Carolina, godly man, and your parents leave you, bequeath to you, I think it was 3,000 slaves? What do you do? Anyone that says, well, you just do the decent thing and release them. You release 3,000 people who were born in Africa, who've had their homes split and divided, who've never been responsible for one decision they've made in their lives. You have sentenced them to incredible tragedy. So here was the dilemma in the South. The brothers in the North, part of the Triennial Convention, which took up all Baptists in America, brothers in the North who were in the abolitionist stream by this time, even though their Constitution did not say it, added language that said, if a person wants to be a missionary from a church where either that person holds slaves, and that was the primary thing, then that person cannot be a missionary under the Triennial Convention. Baptists in the South felt like that was unfair to keep people called to missions. They felt like they were being mistreated, treated in a different way, a different standard. And they could not come to a meeting of the minds, could not come to an agreement, even though they tried. And so in 1845, not because Baptists were in the South were just so adamant about slavery, although some were, to be fair, in 1845, 293 delegates from churches in the South, from Charleston, South Carolina, all the way down the seaboard, all the way into Georgia, Alabama, met in Augusta, Georgia, and formed the Southern Baptist Convention. Not, and you read it in the charter, not so we can hold on to our slaves, but so we can elicit, combine, and direct energies to advance the gospel. To advance the gospel. That's where the Southern Baptist Convention was born. Now, I tell you this, not at all being an apologist for the trouble that was going on, but I am sympathetic that they were people of their times. People of their times. But out of that, we managed to move forward. We managed to there were things started like ministries to the Negro slave. There were people who, as soon as they could, began to emancipate slaves in a timely way. Of course, the Civil War comes along. And the South is ravaged by war. People were forced to choose sides. If you've done any intelligent reading on the war between the states, then you know that it wasn't just the issue of slavery. It was the issue of states' rights versus the rights of the federal government. Up until that time, whatever is not accorded to the federal government in the Constitution is left to the states. That's language in the Constitution. That was eclipsed in the Civil War, where federalism just swept over and began to gobble up states' rights. And that's what the controversy was. I'm not here as an apologist. I'm just telling you that's history. And if you read it honestly, it tells you that's what it was. And so that had a real devastating effect. Baptists came through that, began to start training facilities, the Bible Tract Society. Baptists wrote catechisms. You should be familiar with that term if you're hanging around here at all. And one of the first catechisms was a catechism written to catechize the Negro slave, to educate them. Began to grant, although there were laws written against it in the South, that one of the largest churches in the South was a slave church. And so laws were enacted to keep that where a white preacher either had to be the pastor of that church or had to supervise what was going on. It was a very awful mess. They began to train people for ministry in that area. And so there was this growing sense. If we're going to be evangelistic, if we're going to send people to the ends of the earth with the gospel, we need to be gospel-minded here. And so coming out of their cultural setting, we made great strides. I've said to you before, and I believe this, that if anyone writes an honest history, that in the 60s, during the civil rights upheaval, that white evangelical churches in the South blew it big time. We should have been on the front lines of showing racial reconciliation, of laboring alongside our brothers and sisters of color. Here's part of the problem, though. Let's be honest with history. When these churches embrace something like a Marxism, when they're rejecting key doctrines, it's hard how do two walk together unless they're agreeing. So there's a lot of different movements that were going on that were challenging the desire. And so the white evangelical churches did not do well, have a black eye on us. But we were able to move beyond that by God's grace. And then in recent years, there's begun to be, and I was talking with one of our leaders back in April or May, and he said, Bill, he said, and he's at conventions all the time. He said, I've repented five times for the way the Southern Baptist Convention was started. I've convented for being a racist because I'm white and the Southern Baptist Convention was started over slavery. He said, I know, I've tracked it too. And it's frustrating when you wonder, when do you get forgiven for that? But there's a movement today, troubling me, that's really pushing for that and pushing for that and pushing for that and more racial reconciliation and some showing that we mean it. Well, I mean, recent years, brothers and sisters, Fred Luter, who's a friend of mine, pastor of Franklin Avenue Baptist Church in New Orleans, Louisiana. I knew him when I was in the Louisiana Convention. Black Baptist pastor, was president of the Southern Baptist Convention. But when you get the mentality, well, we haven't done enough. I'm going to tell you something. I don't know how you operate in your life, if husband and wife do this. You will never do enough if that's the mentality. In other words, if grace doesn't settle it, then you can never do enough of anything to make it right. That's just the principle. This is why the scripture says in Ephesians 2, he's torn down the middle wall of partition separating the two. He's made of the two one new man, one new humanity in Christ. So that's a concern that we have. I'll tell you about a couple of other concerns in a minute. As far as the meeting itself, last thing. We got there on our way. One of the concerns was that Paige Patterson, the president of Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, who had just been terminated by the trustees, executive committee of the trustees, was scheduled to preach the convention sermon. Every year at the convention, one of the acts of the order of business committee that the convention messengers have to ratify is who's going to preach the convention sermon next year, who the backup alternate will be. Last year, Dr. Paige Patterson was nominated and elected to preach this year's convention sermon. So there was concern on the part of some that we would, that Baptists would come across looking like they're insensitive to women who've been abused, and we don't want to give that picture. And so there was a call for a motion to amend when the gavel was struck on Tuesday morning, and to change out, to remove Paige Patterson from being the convention sermon preacher. That was going to be controversial. Thankfully, Dr. Paige Patterson withdrew his name just before the convention started, so that was not an issue. And the backup preacher was ready and stepped in to preach at the appropriate time. But that's what we were dealing with headed to the convention. When that was averted, then there was a sense of peace. But you've got to understand, there were many supporters of Paige Patterson at this convention. He's seen as one of the two architects of the conservative resurgence started back in 1979. And there were people there, typically people my age and older, who don't appreciate. The mentality is you can't treat him that way. He's done so much. So they were upset. So there were motions made in the business sessions. And it's a big business meeting for 2 days with preaching and singing and reports interspersed. Okay. Motions made to censure the trustees who voted to fire him. Motions made to fire the trustees who had fired him and to reinstate him. So there was still some friction going on there. We waded through that and without a whole lot of upset about that. Another issue that rose to the surface was that Mike Pence, Vice President of the United States, the White House had contacted some of the leadership on the Committee on Order of Business and said, "Can he come speak?" That caused no small amount of furor, because the younger generation that's rising up behind me, the J.D. Greer, who's the new elected president, age generation in their 40s and all, do not want Southern Baptists to be identified with a political party. And I understand that and agree with that absolutely, perfectly. So that was controversial. And then just the hassle of, if you bring a vice president, the next thing, when you walk up the next morning, there's TSA security checkpoints all across the entrance to the convention. It was wasn't a nightmare it could have been, but it posed the prospect of being a real nightmare. Plus, you tell Southern Baptists, imagine this, we have a business meeting here, and we tell folks, if you're not here by 7, we're locking the doors and you can't get in. You tell Baptists that they can't get into their own meeting at a certain time. And so it caused some friction. My guess is that we'll probably not see, and Mike Pence did a great job speaking. By and large, he had to go off and toot Trump's horn, which I don't think was appropriate. He could have just come and told us how much he appreciated our labor in different causes. But anyway, be that as it may, he spoke. That was a point of controversy. Then J.D. Greer was elected president by like 69% to 31% over Ken Hemphill. There was a challenge to J.D. Because some perceive that he is not staying orthodox as he should. He wrote a book on breaking the Islam code. We referenced it when we did our study on Islam here in one of our small groups. And he used some intemperate language that he shouldn't have used, and people have asked him to change it, and he's honestly been kind of stubborn about it. But J.D. was a missionary, one of our SBC missionaries as a young person, to Indonesia, the most heavily populated Muslim country in the world. And in sharing the gospel and encountering them there, he said, and by the way, so that we don't think this, Blaine Mays and I have talked about these kind of things, that you've got to meet them where they are. If you engage a Muslim in his own country and he thinks he's a Muslim because he was born in that country and he can't be anything else, and he says, well, you're just a Christian because you were born in America. If you meet one and you're engaging them and you say, now you know that Allah, your God, is false, you've lost them immediately. So what our missionaries are learning to do is to take, because Allah means God, and say, you worship Allah. I want to tell you what he's like. And they begin to walk through the attributes of God revealed in Scripture. And I won't go into the whole Muslim witnessing thing, but this is what J.D. was doing. So in his book, he wrote some things that if you read it and you don't know what he's doing, you draw the conclusion. He is saying that Jehovah and Allah are the same God. And Baptists in a certain generation, primarily my generation, just went ballistic when that came out, when people began to promote that and print that. So Ken Hemphill, who's an elder statesman of Southern Baptists and has been serving for years, he agreed to run against J.D. J.D. beat him handily, 69% to 31%, which is very telling. If you're someone like me that studies convention trends and movements, it's very telling. So that happened without a whole lot of controversy. Really, the controversy was before the convention. We got there and voted, and And then we elected an African-American first vice president and Hispanic second vice president. And it was a good slate of officers that were elected at the convention. Great reports from the International Mission Board. As I said, David Platt, the convention commissioned 79 missionaries. You couldn't show their faces. You couldn't tell where they were going, because where they're going, they will lay down their lives, many of them, when they're discovered to be gospel missionaries. North American Mission Board report from Kevin Ezell was a wonderful report. Just great things that are happening. They and Lifeway team together, as I said, for the whole discipleship. You're going to see more emphases on making disciples. That's a good thing. So the reports from the seminaries were good. Jeff Bingham from Southwestern Seminary brought one of the most sane, comforting words about what's happening at Southwestern and what he hopes can happen as they move forward. Al Mohler and Chuck Kelly from Southern and New Orleans, respectively, answered questions about, because there's a movement also, there's a feminist movement in the convention. And people are wanting to see Beth Moore elected president of the convention. They're wanting to see women be allowed to pastor. They wanted to see women be allowed to teach theology to men. And so Al Mohler and Chuck Kelly made it plain in their reports, said what we understand about the scriptures and our charge from Southern Baptists is, while women have many, many places in ministry, and we should accord them every opportunity in ministry afforded them by the scriptures, teaching theology to men in our seminaries and pastoring in our pulpits are not options. So that was comforting to hear these guys, because there's a you're going to be surprised, Wade Burleson, who's a friend of this congregation, is pushing that big time from Enid. Very disappointing. So that's another one of the movements. Three movements. But the most troubling movement, I think, is the Revoice Conference. Revoice, which is going to take place in a week or two now in St. Louis, I believe, is a conference whose stated purpose is supporting, I want you to hear this now, supporting, encouraging, and empowering gay, lesbian, same-sex attracted, and other LGBT Christians so they can flourish while observing the historic Christian doctrine of marriage and sexuality. This was started by a PCA pastor. It's going to be, at a PCA church in St. Louis. But it's been joined by Southern Baptist teachers, figures. You wouldn't know their names. One is the son. He was a teacher at Southern Seminary. His dad was the dean of the Boyce Bible College at Southern Seminary. And so, this is a great concern. Russell Moore, who's a friend, I know Russell, had Russell speak at our camps, is the head of our Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, the ERLC. I went to the booth in the exhibit hall to try to talk to Russell. He was not there, so I spoke with one of his associates about this, being troubled about this. He said that one of the teaching fellows, a young woman who has come out and endorsed this, and she's a research fellow for the ERLC. She's also a professor of English at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. I mean, folks, it's just enough to blow your mind when you think about the inroads. I said, what do you think about her? She's identified with y'all. He said, I know. He said, we've got a split on it on the staff. I said, what does Russell think? He said, you're going to have to ask Russell what he thinks. So, tried to do that at the convention. Time ran out for the report time. But a fellow did ask him before me. He didn't ask it like I would have asked it. I thought he was kind of bullying in his tone. But and Russell answered, the question was, are you going to censure or what about this woman who's one of your research fellows who's endorsed the Revoice Conference? And Russell said, well, I don't know about Revoice. And he began to defend her. What a wonderful woman she was. Well, there's lots been written after that, because it's hard to believe that the head of our Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, who is on the cutting edge of every cultural and societal movement taking place, does not know about this conference. And we have yet to hear him respond. People have been calling him, you need to speak to this, Russell, and tell us what your thoughts are on this. But this is an assault, and if you read about Revoice, R-E-V-O-I-C-E.us, that's their site, they're going to say that they're coming up with a term, it's sexual minorities. We need to grant sexual minorities membership status in our churches. These are LGBT, the gay, lesbian, whatever, who have same-sex attraction, but are committed to celibacy, as the Scripture demands, and recognize that marriage can only take place between a man and a woman. That's their mantra. Brothers and sisters, you should know that if you let the camel get his nose under the tent, it's just a matter of time before the camel is in the tent, and you can't get him out once he gets in the tent. And so the Revoice Conference is a very great concern. We'll be watching it to see what happens in the next few weeks. But those are three things. For all the encouragements that we had at the convention, all the good reports, all the honesty about how we're not healthy in disciple making, we need to get there. The challenges given, the reports of the stories of people experiencing solid conversions among Muslims, more Muslims coming to Christ now than at any time in history. For all those great reports, there were these three concerns: this continual push for reconciliation, racial reconciliation. I am all for racial reconciliation. My question to those is, we've repented five times formally as a convention. When do we get forgiven? To those who are pushing feminism to grant women their status, in the name, by the way, of the whole Me Too movement, that we've discovered that one or more of our leaders has either allowed or participated in the abuse of women. Shouldn't we grant women equal status? The Scripture teaches otherwise. I love women. We encourage women here to be all that God called you to be. But there's some things that God has reserved in the whole male-female role relationship, that to go there is a bridge too far, and we will offend God when He's made it clear that there are certain things that He reserves for men, because He intends to call men to ultimate account. So that movement of feminism that's now got wind in the SBC, and then, of course, the Revoice matter. Those are the three concerns I come away with. J.D. Greer is a very capable young man. He's a tremendous teacher and preacher. He has more people, listen to this, 7 to 10 times more people coming out of the church he pastors at Summit in North Carolina on the mission field for Southern Baptists, 7 to 10 times more than the next closest Southern Baptist church. He's a mission-minded pastor. He gives his people charges. He's at an intersection of these major universities, and college students are just being really trained and influenced through his ministry. And he's challenging them. He tells the story about, he said, you know you're dealing in a college town when you pass the offering plate and there's a partially eaten McDonald's burger in the plate with a note that says, "It's all I had." He's a great guy. I have great regard for him. I love him. And I'm concerned. I'm concerned about who's going to influence him. If he is going to go drifting, the next 2 years, you get elected a year, then you're eligible to be reelected another year. These next 2 years are going to be critical for Southern Baptists to see if we're going to hold the line. And we said this years ago when the battle for the Bible, the battle for inerrancy was won. At Founders Ministries, we were saying, you know, that's wonderful, the authority of Scripture. But you've got to go beyond inerrancy. And it shouldn't surprise you to hear this term. You've got to demonstrate sufficiency. And here's what we're facing right now, is that these movements that are afoot are basically saying that the gospel of Jesus Christ, which brings together all kinds of people that couldn't get together otherwise, is not sufficient to make it happen. These dear friends of ours would reject that, but that's the net effect of it. That the gospel is sufficient. We don't need to go after quotas. We don't need to prove anything to the world that we're sincere. This was one of the arguments made about removing Paige Patterson from the convention floor. Was if we don't, then women around the world are going to say, Southern Baptists don't care about women being abused. We have got to be careful that we don't unwittingly bow to the culture. We bow to Jesus as King, and that's it. And so I came away from the Southern Baptist Convention, came to tell you, encouraged about a lot of things, but concerned about those three areas. The push for, which I think is happening by race baiting types, who are taking their cue more from Obama than they are from Jesus Christ. The push for feminism, you know where that's coming from. And the push for sexual minorities. What a wicked euphemism. Sexual minorities. Because if you identify something as a minority, what do you need to do? Work overtime to grant equal status to it. So that's where we are as a convention. Any questions or comments you have for clarification? I've dumped a lot of stuff on you, but yes, Karen. No. This is not funded. Thank you. Excellent question. It's not funded by Southern Baptist Revoice Conference. It's not funded by the PCA, by the way. Here's an interesting challenge, though. PCA is not built like us. PCA is a top-down denomination, and people are asking, is this fella who is pushing this, is he going to be removed from the session, would be their terms that they use. Will you step forward and remove him for having deviated from the historic doctrinal faith? PCA does that. Southern Baptists don't. That's a local church issue. If you found out that I was out promoting a sexual minority LGBT conference, I would hope you would rise up and remove me for deviating from the Christian faith. Good question. So no monies are going in. Just, Karen, what you have is personalities who have taught in our seminaries who are supporting it. And then you have the head of our ERLC who has been virtually silent on it to say to our denomination, it just took my breath away. I don't know about Revoice. I was standing at the microphone to ask him a question. Time expired. It was just breathtaking. Anybody else? Yes, Lynn. For Wade Burleson has embraced the idea of women ought to be allowed to teach and preach in the same capacities as men. He's one of the ones that he and another guy are commending Beth Moore. And unless things change, I'm not a prophet and the son of a prophet. I'm the son of an appliance salesman. But in 2020, when J.D. is finishing up his second term, and we're going to be meeting somewhere out in California, you mark my words, Beth Moore will be nominated for president of the Southern Baptist Convention. It's coming. Good question. Clarification. Anybody else? Linda. Northern Baptists, American Baptists, they have some different groups up there. Because when Southern Baptists split, then it was no longer the triennial. So they came up with different names. But there's a Northern Baptist and there's American Baptist. Both of those today are very liberal groups. They will have exceptions. They've got pockets. Conservatives holding on, bless their heart. By the way, Karen and I went over, didn't know this, we just stumbled in after the convention to one of the hotels there nearby, and the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship was meeting there. I don't know if you know who that is. When the liberals and moderates realized they had lost the day in the conservative resurgence in the Southern Baptist Convention, they started the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, CBF. And they were in town having their general session, they call it. They've come up with different language too, so that they don't look like us at all. And Karen and I walked through one of their areas where they were having breakout sessions. And I took some pictures of the titles of the breakout sections. And I didn't know whether to laugh or weep. finding safe space. You know, making our churches, I mean, just the whole language, they just embrace the language of the culture. And they're, one of their biggest celebration nights was celebrating all the great women pastors in their fellowship. So they have, as was predicted, they have just gone. And now one of the big debates in the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship is, well, what about these sexual minorities? Are we not going to grant them equal status as Christians? If they've been called to minister, who are we to say they can't? So that's what we could have been, folks. Tragically, after fighting and winning the battle for the Bible, I'm not going to say that we've gotten there yet, but it seems to be there's a rumbling of some who would not be altogether disappointed to see us go that way. I don't want to be overly dramatic about it. We've got 2 years to watch and pray for J.D. Greer, G-R-E-E-A-R. Young man in his 40s, youngest person elected president in 37, 39 years, but a wonderful guy. Anybody else? All right. Well, thanks for enduring this. I hope we didn't overload you, but I did want to bring you up to speed. Thank you for sending Karen and myself to represent us. We were messengers from Bethel Baptist Church. They'd left the mic on when I was wanting to ask my question, I would have said, I'm Bill Askell, pastor and messenger from the Bethel Baptist Church in Owosso, Oklahoma, because that's why I was there. And you did that. You sent us. So thank you for doing that. Yes, JR? No, they give limited time for the reports and stuff.